This is Marketplace Weekend. I'm Lizzie O'Leary.
Since Equifax was compromised, we've been wondering just why we use our social security numbers for so much anyway. If somebody gets a hold of yours, things can get bad fast. And we will get to that in a little bit and the rest of Jeffrey Amuro's story. But we're going to start with Irma, Harvey, and their catastrophic cousins. It's no secret that recovering from disaster takes a lot of time and a lot of money. The federal government says Hurricane Katrina cost about $160 billion in damages. For Harvey, experts predict somewhere between $150 to $180 billion. But what about rebuilding? And what about preparing for the next disaster?
Our current paradigm is based on our historical experience with disasters. Unfortunately, because of increased population, development along our coasts, we're seeing far greater cost in our disaster recovery.
Alice Hill is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Before that, she was with the Homeland Security Department and served on President Obama's National Security Council. She's thought a lot about how to rebuild after disasters. And right now, most experts say $1 of disaster prevention saves about $4 on cleanup and recovery. So I asked Hill whether and how we should realign our priorities.
Well, that's the challenge. Because as you've alluded to, when we have a bad event, it's very emotional for all of us. Of course, we want to help our fellow citizens, and we want to make sure everyone's safe. The problem is that we end up rewarding communities in some instances for not taking the necessary precautions in advance, for example, by having stricter building codes, limits on development in floodplains. Those kinds of steps can help reduce the damage from future disasters. It doesn't prevent the extreme weather, but it just makes us more resilient to those impacts.
How do we think about who pays for all of this? I mean, right now, you know, FEMA gives out some disaster preparedness grants that those pale in comparison to emergency relief funding. But, you know, does that mean that rich homeowners are going to be better prepared for some sort of scary event than someone who's less well off?
Absolutely. Our most vulnerable communities are the ones that feel these impacts often the greatest. They're living in housing that may not have the kind of resilient measures that a more expensive home would have. But if we require it in our building codes, that should ensure that there's a base level of resiliency. The question as to who pays after these disasters is what I guess used to be the $64,000 question, and now it's probably the $64 billion or more question. The issue is if a community decides not to have strong building codes and they are hit with accelerating events, which we are seeing as a result of a warming climate, then the question becomes who pays for that decision if the house doesn't withstand it? Right now, our paradigm is that if the event is truly catastrophic, the federal taxpayers pay. It's been argued that perhaps we need a new paradigm that would require essentially that any community that takes money in the face of these very challenging circumstances builds back better for the future.
One of the things that I remember being struck by when I covered the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina was some of the rules that governed how federal money could be spent. For example, you know, FEMA funds couldn't be used to improve something, only to make it really what it was prior to the storm. What would you change in the rules that dictate how we prepare for disasters and how we spend money at the federal level?
One of the clear things that we can do going forward is commit as a nation that we are going to rebuild better so that we are prepared for the events that the science tells us will reasonably occur in the foreseeable future. Our typical infrastructure could last 100 years. Right here in Washington, D.C., we have drainage pipes that date from the Civil War. I have to say kudos to those civil engineers that they're still in operation. But as we replace those over time, we need to be mindful that here in Washington, D.C., we will see increased precipitation as a result of warming temperatures, and we need to build those bigger and also plan that they might be in use 100 years, and that would be a good use of our money if they were.
If I want to spin this out to sort of its most extreme conclusion, does that mean then that, let's say I want to build a house on the coast in Georgia or Louisiana, can the government say, no, you can't do that? It's just too dangerous?
I'm not proposing that we get involved in individual zoning decisions. The zoning decisions are made on the local level. That is not a federal, typically a federal matter. What I am suggesting is if you take federal money to build that house, or you want a subsidy to purchase federal insurance, which is often what happens or frequently happens in the United States, you need to build resiliently. And if you're taking taxpayer money to make that choice, I think the taxpayers can demand that that investment be resilient.
You know, I guess what I keep coming back to, and maybe this is me being dense, or maybe it's something fundamentally human about not thinking disaster is going to strike. Why do we keep doing the same thing over and over again when the costs are so clearly piling up?
We have a huge range of challenges here. The incentives aren't completely aligned. Home builders will tell you that their interest is providing homes as cheaply as possible to increase home ownership. Of course, if you want to do that, you will find that it's cheaper to build if you don't build to a higher standard or a stricter building code. It may be a modest increase to accomplish that, but even a simple nail that's costs about $15 per roof, home builders have opposed that in high wind areas just simply for that cost. So we see that their incentives are misaligned.
I mean, do they have an argument? You know, in Florida, some of the home builders are saying, well, but that's going to hurt the affordable housing stock.
You know, in ancient times, the first building code, they said basically it was a penalty of death if the house failed for the home builder. Certainly we don't want that, but we have to find a way to say we need to insist on higher standards to protect those who are going to have to help in recovery. We have done a really remarkable job in protecting life through building codes, and that is something that we should applaud. As tragic as it is to see any loss of life in any of these events, that is greatly reduced from what you would expect. But what we are seeing is greater increases in the cost of damages, both in disruption costs in terms of businesses, it's slower for them to get back up, as well as just the cost of repair and restoring. So the issue is, who's going to pay? And that, I think, is the fundamental question that all of us need to be fully engaged upon as we talk about what recovery looks like for these types of events.
Alice Hill is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Thank you.
Thank you.